This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to have three very distinguished guests, three philosophers from three different parts of the world, with me to talk about a book that they've recently written for Oxford University Press. The book is called The Oxford Handbook of Roman Philosophy. So with me to discuss this book, I've got Professor Myrto Garani, an Associate Professor of Latin Literature at the National and Kapodisterian University of Athens. I hope I'm not mispronouncing the name, but I'll let you correct me if I'm wrong. I've got David Constant, Professor of Classics at New York University, and Professor Gretchen Radams-Shields, Professor of Program of Liberal Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Welcome to New Books Network.
Glad to be here.
Before we start, I'll just very briefly ask you to introduce yourself and talk about your field of expertise. So I've got David on top of the screen, so I'll start with David. David, can you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background?
Certainly. I'm a professor of classics at New York University, as most of us have pointed out. I specialize in a number of areas, but the history of philosophy, and particularly Epicureanism and Aristotle, are specialties of mine. I have also worked on the history of ideas, and so I have written books on the emotions of the ancient Greeks, and more particularly books on friendship, on pity, on love and other sentiments. So that's my background. Just as a piece of odd information, I did my undergraduate studies in mathematics and then changed very late and very happily to the classics.
Mathematics and philosophy, yeah, that kind of explains it. So let's go to Gretchen. Thank you.
Yeah, hello. So my name is not only a mouthful, but I also have a number of academic affiliations. So my home department at University of Notre Dame, the Program of Liberal Studies, is a general humanities department, and there are not that many of those around. So that's very distinctive. But I have a background in classics all the way through, and I always focused on ancient philosophy. So at Notre Dame, I also have concurrent appointments in classics, in philosophy, and in theology, because a number of the things that I work on are related to those fields. I work mostly on the traditions of Platonism and Stoicism, and also on the reception of Plato's Timaeus. And in Stoicism, I have worked quite a bit on the so-called late or Roman Stoics, and those, of course, are contemporary with developments in early Christianity, hence also the crossover into religious studies. I have also very strong interest in Philo of Alexandria, the Jewish Greek author Philo of Alexandria.
Thank you, Gretchen. And Myrto?
Thank you very much. I am Myrto Garani. I am based at the University of Athens, the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens. I'm an associate professor in Latin literature, and I mainly work in Lucretius and recently in Seneca. I have studied I did my BA in Thessaloniki, and then I moved to London at King's College to do my PhD. And then I had a job in the University of Patras. And since 2011, I am at the University of Athens.
Thank you very much. So the book, Oxford Handbook of Roman Philosophy, so the book was published in 2023. There are about 34 articles, but and you have all contributed an article to this book, which we'll talk about soon. But before that, can I ask, first of all, why you decided to write this book or put together this series of articles about Roman philosophy, and how it was, what it was like to do to this collaboration to write the book? And then I'm going to ask, I do not come from a philosophy background myself, so and I'm trying to introduce this book to myself and also to the unaffiliated, uninitiated people like myself again. So when it comes to philosophy, we usually assume Greek and Roman philosophy to be one and the same. So the second part of my question is it the right perception?
Well, we agreed that I would start off with some comments. No, it's not the same. But I think what happened, maybe one of the big changes with this volume is that we sort of move away from the Roman tradition as merely receiving the Greek tradition, and translating it and adapting it into really this idea that Roman philosophy is something in its own right. But to put this book together, which in a way I should probably also say we inherited from a previous set of editors, we rescued it. So it's a bit of a labor of love. But we have a very broad concept of philosophy, and that's very, very important. It's also how this mode of discourse, if you want, relates to other cultural practices, such as rhetoric, for example.
I would add just a note that, of course, we were all in agreement that Roman philosophy is something and it responds to the conditions of Roman life. So the very decision to look at Roman philosophy as a whole, covering its various manifestations, is historical in character. It asks us what happens when one very developed philosophical tradition is transformed and adapted to a new culture and new cultural circumstances. One could ask the same question, for example, about how ancient philosophy, or let us say German philosophy, when it enters into Anglo-Saxon world, is transformed and changed. The language is different, the cultural determinants are different, the values may be different, and sometimes at a very basic level, where, let's say, because of historical circumstances in, let's say, 18th century Germany, there would have been a concentration on a kind of idealist sense of what philosophy was dealing with. In an Anglo-Saxon tradition 2 centuries later, there might have been much more pragmatic emphasis. It would manifest itself in the way teaching went on, in the way popular discussions took place, and learned scholars and philosophers would address themselves to these issues. So, in all these ways, we found it enlightening and important to set up to recognize the authenticity of Roman philosophy as a whole. Every individual that we deal with and each topic that we deal with has its own special determinants. And there were in collecting the essays, this is what distinguishes our book in some ways from ordinary handbooks. We did not ask for simply a survey. We weren't interested. We were interested in original articles that took a stand, that offered an interesting perspective, always bearing in mind that it was Roman philosophy that we wanted to elicit from these analyses, so that each essay can be read independently and read in a very different way from the others. There's no format. There is no way in which the same type of question is asked or the same structure to the several essays. And we concluded that this is a virtue of the book.
Yeah, so a good label to describe it would say it's like new directions in research would be one good way of putting rather than a survey.
And I must say that I concur with you, because when I was going through the list of the articles, there were lots and lots of new topics to me, and I could tell it's kind of different from other handbooks of philosophy that I'd seen before, whether it's Oxford, Cambridge, or even Blackwell's handbooks, I guess. Another question that I have is, was there much what happened to the Greeks' idea when they moved into Roman conquer? Was there much transformation there, or it was a transition?
I would say a little of both. There was the Romans recognized the power of a Greek thought, which had been elaborated earlier than the time in which Roman culture became very self-conscious and was developing its own literary forms. So if you think that Plato and Aristotle were writing in the 4th century, we don't have any major texts from 4th century Rome in Latin, still less. So have the inscriptions and so on, but those aren't philosophical treatises. We have to wait some time. And so Roman philosophy takes over when Greek philosophy had already matured, and when many Greek philosophers were moving to Rome, or Rome had now expanded its empire to the point in which it absorbed the home cities of many Greek philosophers. So there's this complex interaction of traditions. The one that I might compare with it with is the way that Japan inherited Chinese culture. To some extent, in literary matters and also in philosophical, Russia would be a good example of its relationship to French philosophy. So these are well-known phenomena of transition and transference of cultures. However, that having been said, the Roman philosophers, contrary to what is often assumed, were brilliant, not just in adapting the philosophy, but in making it come alive and for new purposes and in new contexts. And this is what we have constantly tried to elicit. Seneca was writing for Romans. Cicero was writing for Romans. They were continually aware of it, and the form and content of their arguments tends to change, the emphases certainly, and these are what we sought to bring out in this change. Gretchen has her hand up. You're muted, Gretchen.
I had a bit of an aha moment recently. So, one of the things that I've been pushing against, particularly in Stoicism, is the sort of view that once Stoicism reached Rome, it becomes sort of this weaker, more socially conventional version of its older self. So, that's one version in which adapting to Roman culture has become a kind of cliché. But the aha moment that I had recently is that, of course, Cicero wants to adapt Stoicism to Rome, but the relation also works in the other direction. His ideal Rome is very much shaped by Stoicism. So, and that is very, very important to realize. And in many traditional accounts, you only find the first component, how he adapts Stoicism to Roman sensitivities and Roman concerns. But if you read his work on the Republica, on the De Legibus, it's very clear that his ideal Rome is very much influenced by Stoic ideas and that it also works in the other direction.
Before we talk about your specific contributions to this book, can I ask you to broadly introduce the structure of the book? The book has 4 parts, and there is a series of articles that are in each section. Can you just broadly tell us how the structure works and what are the broad themes that you have covered in this book?
Mirto, do you have it handy?
I don't have the structure in front of me.
I can talk about it. So the first part is the Roman philosopher, affiliation, identity, self, and the other. The second part is writing and arguing Roman philosophy. Third part, inside and outside of Roman philosophy. And fourth part, after Roman philosophy, transmission and impact.
Yes, it's good to be reminded. We've been working on this, the publication date doesn't tell you when we last were examining these things, which is long before. You can see the relevance of the last part, and it's become conventional in handbooks today to talk about what we call reception. Very often, looking much, much later and in much larger proportion in relation to the book as a whole, at how any particular ancient theme has been received today. So if you look at a book on the ancient novel, if you look at a book on ancient rhetoric, you'll often see as much as a third of the entire volume dedicated to its subsequent influence. Great encyclopedia of Real Lexicon de für Antike, what is it, Wissenschaft, is now publishes several volumes solely dedicated to reception in different areas of the world. That was part of our motivation, but not exclusively. We really wanted to see creative adaptations that would shed light on the what was, in our view, a book of reception to begin with. So we were doing reception from beginning to end. And that gave it a special quality. Also, we want to distinguish between essays dedicated to an entire school and essays dedicated to a theme. So it'd be one thing to look at Stoicism and another thing to look at time or pleasure or some such specific topic as it is elaborated in Rome and what ways it might be different and developing on ancient Greek conceptions.
Yeah, and then there were some contributions on how they present philosophy and the philosopher. So there's also there are also contributions on that. What does it mean to be a philosopher in this context? So you can have an author, you can have a school, you can have the presentation of philosophy, you can have a theme, and then the last part is reception.
Now, let's talk about some of the articles you wrote. So we'll start with David. You did mention that you've published on the ideas of friendship and emotions in Greek philosophy. And I guess that makes sense that you have written an article on Cicero's idea of friendship, on friendship. Can you tell us about this article that you've written, which is called Philosophers and Roman Friendship?
Yes, one of the immediately obvious features of my contribution is that I focused exclusively on one text, and that was Cicero's Essay on Friendship. I did so because I thought it is such a rich text, so informative about so many aspects of how Roman philosophy is a Roman understanding of an important theme both was responsible to and at the same time responsive to and at the same time innovative, that to have added sections on things about friendship all over the field would have complicated matters considerably. The Epicureans, for example, thought friendship was extremely important, and others in our volume do discuss it, but it would have led me astray, and the article would have gotten completely out of hand. So it was better to concentrate on this one initial text. In looking at it, there were several features that came to light at once. Let me illustrate one. Aristotle, in his treatise on ethics, the Nicomachean Ethics, and also the Eudemian Ethics, devotes a good deal of attention to friendship. In fact, one-fifth of the book on ethics is devoted to friendship, and it's a long book. So in all of that time, Aristotle neglected to raise one question, and it is, if a friend of yours should ask you to do something that runs contrary to the interests of the state as you perceive it, of society, should you do so? Should you help the friend in a project we don't necessarily regard as criminal, just something to be done, maybe a political enterprise. Since friends owe each other loyalty, where do you draw the line? Where do you reject a request on the part of a friend? And Cicero raises a particular case. There was a Stoic named Blossius, who, according to tradition, whether it's true or not, was a very good friend of the Gracchi, the Gracchus brothers, who were these revolutionaries in the late second century BC Rome, and very supportive. And so Cicero raises the question, if Gracchus would have asked you to burn down the temple to Zeus, to Jupiter, would you have done so? And Blossius says, he would never have asked me to do that. And Cicero's spokesman pushes and says, but if he had, and Blossius says, yes, I would have. And Cicero there says, this is destructive to the state. You burn down the temple that represents Rome's identity more than any other. How could that be compatible with virtue and a civic person's duty? And that's a question, interestingly, that Aristotle did not raise. He would have been conscious of it, but he didn't raise it. And I asked then, why not? Why does this become an urgent matter for Cicero when it was not an urgent matter for Aristotle? Perhaps it's in the difference in the nature of government. Perhaps it's in the living through a period of intense social crisis. Cicero lived through the assassination of Julius Caesar. And in its aftermath, he himself was assassinated. He fought battles against conspiracies against the state continually. And he had many friends. And many of his friends were on multiple sides of a question. So I thought, just in this respect, Cicero was a fascinating test case of how a Roman might think to make his arguments about friendship. He clearly had to put constraints. But then comes the question, how much, when, how do you decide? What if burning down the temple was a good strategy to do, terrible as it would be seem, because it would lead to better results? This might be true, and if it were true, were you then acting on behalf of your friend because the friend was right or because you were loyal? And those are the questions. I noticed, in fact, in another context in which I was writing something, that loyalty is never raised as a virtue among the Greeks and Romans, loyalty per se. And you can see why. Here is just why. Loyalty is terribly problematic. And something that is problematic and needs to be violated in certain conditions can't become a virtue, which is something that should be positive in all contexts. So here's an initial response to your question. I know you had some others.
Thank you. And I think it kind of very contemporary as well, the idea of loyalty, whether it's virtue or not. We can see it in political parties. If you simply add a loyalty, you vote for something you don't really believe in, or vote something that is destructive to you. Yeah.
It absolutely is. I could add one thing. There was a long tradition in the study of Greek and Roman friendship, but especially Roman, that argued that friendship, in fact, was not a sentimental relationship based on affection, but was a kind of agreement between people, a kind of contract, a kind of set of obligations. You acknowledged a friend, and that friend was your associate. It was kind of compact between people. And the sentimental, the personal values, the affection really meant much less. And sometimes people argued practically nothing. That friendship, as the Romans used the word, was a political phenomenon. People on the same side of a political spectrum were friends. And people who were on the opposite side, they were friends among themselves, and friendship could not cross the boundary. We can think of that as being very relevant today, where I read, even a couple of years ago, in a poll that the greatest obstacle toward getting married is when the two partners differ on politics, whereas in previous decades, it had always been things like religion or other kinds of values. Politics suddenly became the overriding consideration. No, I would never marry a Trump person or a Trump person. No, I'd never marry somebody who voted for Biden. And it's real. And there you had it. Now, that was the reigning interpretation of Roman friendship. And I argued that it was mistaken, that Romans, like Greeks, thought of their friends as the people they liked for various reasons. Because they shared values, yes. Because they respected and saw very fine qualities of character in the other, absolutely. And Cicero states that friendship is a function of love. He relates etymologically the two terms amicitia, which is friendship, and amor, which is love. And he says amicitia comes from amor. And amor is never pragmatic. You don't love people out of self-interest or out of a deficiency in yourself. You love them for their qualities. Love is generous. Love is giving. And this is what constitutes love. And what was remarkable is the extent to which Cicero's views were dismissed, but completely in this alternative interpretation, which rendered it strictly and narrowly political. So there was another dimension. As it happens, in Greek, this particular tension didn't arise in the same way, because the word philia meant love or friendship indiscriminately. Whereas in Latin, there had grown, they developed a special word just for friendship. And there was a whole history of dissident interpretations, a whole debate over whether the Greeks even thought of friends in the way that we do today when they spoke of a friend, or did they? Was it a much more inclusive term, meaning anybody you love? In Latin, the distinction of vocabulary was clear, but it was left for people to draw some of the conclusions. And here again, we have Cicero to look back to and see how he developed these differences. You're muted.
Thank you very much, David. Let's go to Myrto to talk about her article, Roman Pre-Socratics, Biodoxography in the Late Republic. So Myrto, can you please talk about your article? I myself did not know the meaning of biodoxography before reading the article. So I'd appreciate it if you could tell us what it is, and you talk about a number of philosophers, such as Cicero again. Can you talk about your article and the major contention of the article?
Okay, thank you very much. With only a few notable exceptions, the students of pre-Socratic philosophers are faced with a textual vacuum. The reconstruction of the pre-Socratic doctrines and the access to their original meaning are intrinsically tied to Latin philosophical or philosophizing authors. An exhaustive mapping of pre-Socratic references within Roman writers would be far from realistic, since it would require a larger scale study still to be done. In the absence of such a work in my chapter, I focused upon three contemporaneous writers who were active in Italy around the end of the Republic, namely Philodemus of Gadara, Lucretius, and Cicero. Within these authors, rather than gleaning scattered and isolated references to certain pre-Socratic thinkers, I prioritize specific passages in which there is some sort of a list of pre-Socratic philosophers. First, I delve into the specific sources from which these authors drew their information and explore whether they relied for their accounts upon their exclusive and direct access to the pre-Socratic doctrines, or if their reading was instead mediated through certain interpretative prisms. As I argue, the formation of what we call Roman pre-Socratics, i.e. the distorted image that Romans of the first century BC had of their pre-Socratic predecessors, is heavily dependent both on the Hellenistic biographies of the pre-Socratics, as these are reflected in Diogenes Laertius' work Lives of Eminent Philosophers, and the doxographical tradition. Let me add, as you asked for, a brief comment on the meaning of the term doxography, which is derived from the two Greek words doxa, tenet, view, opinion, and graphin, to write. Literally, it means the writing of tenets, views, or opinions. Such opinions are also called in Greek areskoda, and in Latin placita, literally what it pleases one to think, and just think of the of placebo for medical treatment. When we are talking about the tradition of placita, we are referring to, roughly put it, to works or sections of works in which opinions of philosophers are briefly formulated and organized in order to show how philosophical questions or topics have been dealt with. The emphasis generally falls more on the topic than on the philosopher. The combination of both these channels of filtering and transmitting the pre-Socratic doctrines to Rome, i.e. Hellenistic biographies and doxographical texts, are eloquently encapsulated in a scholar's coinage, biodoxography. In my chapter, I also discuss the purposes that pre-Socratic references serve in the three authors under investigation, and thus the role that the pre-Socratics were summoned to play in the new Roman environment. Why would a Roman be interested in the integration of pre-Socratic ideas in his own system of thought? Should we consider these texts as reliable sources for the pre-Socratic theories? Or conversely, had the biased reception of the pre-Socratics by these Roman authors any particular influence on the way they were themselves appreciated and comprehended in turn by later writers? And I could talk a bit more about its author separately.
Yeah, it would be great if you could choose one or two of the authors to talk about.
Okay, so first about Philodemus of Gadara, who was an Epicurean philosopher and epigrammatist who moved to Italy probably in the 70s BC. His voluminous treatises were buried due to the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD, but fortunately in the mid-18th century, numerous fragments were discovered in the volcanic ashes of a grand villa in Herculaneum near Naples, and gradually began to be deciphered, first thanks to the astuteness and patience of scholars, and then thanks to the technological advances. In one of these works, entitled Arrangements of the Philosophers, Epicurus discusses philosophy with his three brothers. Philodemus' work appears to have been highly influenced by the Hellenistic genre of philosophical histories called successions of philosophers, in Greek, diadochē. In the successions, the philosophers are organized in long lists of pupils and disciples, with the focus placed on the special ties that group together various philosophers in terms of teacher-disciple relationship rather than on individuals. As for the purpose of such a work by Philodemus, it seems that it was an institutional manual targeted at an educated Roman elite. Philodemus appears to have had at his disposal wide-ranging biographical material upon which he draws in order to write a work structured according to the succession literature. It is important to bear in mind that despite his Epicurean identity, that could, or in fact should, dictate the opposite, Philodemus did not approach his philosophical predecessors, pre-Socratics included, in a polemical spirit, but rather in a historical one. Philodemus on Piety is perhaps his only treatise in which the pre-Socratic presence is indisputably attested at considerable length. By means of this treatise, Philodemus responds to a Stoic critique of Epicurean theology. Within this framework, he sharply criticizes the theology of Greek philosophers, but the segment of the list in which Philodemus introduces the Roman pre-Socratics starts with Thales, 6th century BC, and goes down to Diogenes of Apollonia, dated to the 2nd century BC. Philodemus builds his refutation on the epistemological basis that instead of perceiving the true nature of Epicurean gods, these philosophers favored insensate, inanimate, non-anthropomorphic divinities. Philodemus employs the refutation of various pre-Socratic ideas about the gods as the preparatory stage in an argumentative vehicle in order to undermine the corresponding Stoic theory with which his discussion culminates and to show that this theory is ridiculous and self-contradictory. The most elaborate evidence for the Roman reception of the pre-Socratic philosophers in the late Republic derives from Lucretius' poem De Rerum Natura, On the Nature of Things, an epic poem with a distinctive Epicurean standpoint and explicit didactic goal. In the first book of his poem, Lucretius expounds the basic principle of the Epicurean doctrine, establishes the existence of matter and void, and identifies the atoms along with their properties. He then launches a harsh attack against three particular pre-Socratic philosophers, i.e. Heraclitus, Empedocles, and Anaxagoras, so as to refute monism, finite pluralism, and infinite pluralism, respectively. This passage is called Lucretius' Critique. In my chapter, I focus upon the reasons for Lucretius' misunderstanding of certain pre-Socratic doctrines, as well as his possible familiarity with original pre-Socratic texts. I also explore whether and why Lucretius further elaborated the information that he derived either directly from the pre-Socratics or already filtered through an intermediary source. As I show, the critique bears the strong imprint of the biographical tradition which Lucretius developed on the basis on a certain toxographical text. Yet, Lucretius also infused this tradition with his independent knowledge of the three pre-Socratics so as to build his own poetic account. Although Lucretius turns to a post-Epicurus doxographical text as his starting point, he nevertheless sets himself apart from the Epicurean school. While he plausibly adopts a harsher voice than his master, or even his source, against Heraclitus and Anaxagoras, he presents us with a heavily biased account in which he distorts the pre-Socratic doctrines and imposes his own judgment about his predecessors' personalities and writing style. As to the question whether Lucretius' bidoxographical critique could in any possible way present contemporary and later readers with a reliable image of these pre-Socratics, and more specifically of their philosophical tenets, our answer definitely must be negative. Still, Lucretius' account, and more generally his poem, proved particularly influential, especially as far as the prioritizing of Empedocles over the other pre-Socratics by the Romans. And just a few words about Cicero, who in the period after Julius Caesar's victory over Pompey at Pharsalus was obliged to withdraw from active political life. It was then that he devoted himself to philosophical writing. During an extremely prolific period that lasted almost 2 years, 45-44, Cicero made an unparalleled attempt to render Greek philosophy into the Latin language in the form of dialogues after his Platonic model. Given that the main focus of Cicero's works is ethical philosophy, concrete references to pre-Socratic philosophers within his corpus are understandably scarce. Despite his vast knowledge of Greek, because of the speed and haste with which he composed his philosophical dialogues, Cicero was often obliged to turn to handbooks. For our discussion, we should first turn to his dialogue De Natura Deorum, I on the Nature of Gods, in which Cicero offers his own version of the history of theology and expounds the philosophical disagreement between the Epicureans and the Stoics on the existence and nature of gods. Along these lines, Cicero presents us with a criticism of the theologies of 27 philosophers. This account contains a doxography which mirrors the doxographical section of Philodemus on piety that I have already discussed a few minutes ago. There are two specific facets of this doxographical list which we should draw our attention, given the fact that they pertain to Cicero's method of refutation, his misrepresentation of specific pre-Socratic views, as well as the sharpening of his critical tone compared to that of Philodemus. One wonders about Cicero's specific reasons for revising, instead of just translating, so to speak, Philodemus' doxographical list. We could argue that within the Epicurean universe, there is no place for any of his pre-Socratic predecessors, or at least this is what Cicero would have them say. They should all be equally ostracized, even if for this purpose their views must first be distorted. Rather than going further details about the way in which Cicero treats, or rather maltreats, the pre-Socratics, I would rather summarize now my findings so as to leave space for anyone who is interested in to draw the information from my chapter itself. With Philodemus in his historical arrangement of the philosophers being perhaps the only exception, I argue in my chapter that philosophical and philosophizing writers who were active during the late Republic did not make a great effort to understand the pre-Socratics for their own sake. On the other hand, the Epicureans refute the pre-Socratics in order to establish their own unique truth, and then the academics cite them positively since they are interested in showing that there is a historical continuity in their philosophical thought. In both cases, the discussion of the pre-Socratic doctrines is conditioned by prejudice, misapprehension, a deliberate misrepresentation. Provided that the Roman contemporaneous readers had limited independent access to the original Greek texts, it was through such a distorting lens that they first became acquainted with pre-Socratic ideas.
Thank you very much for the comprehensive overview of the article. Now we move to Gretchen to talk about Seneca and Stoicism and the influence of Platonic psychology in Seneca. So, and the title of the article is Seneca and Stoic Moral Psychology.
Yes, thank you. Maybe I should start by explaining what we mean by moral psychology. So in a lot of theories in ancient philosophy, there are certain views of the soul or the inner constitution of a human being that have direct relevance for ethics or the way we should lead our lives. So that's what we mean by moral psychology in that context. What I try to do in my paper is also to push back against some of the misconceptions that are gradually disappearing, but they still, you know, they still surface here and there. So I've already alluded to one in our introduction that Roman philosophy is merely a kind of watering down. It's a lukewarm version of original Stoicism, but Seneca, like a lot of the later Platonists, is still in some corners grouped together with popular moralizing, meaning that it's not really an in-depth philosophical account. It's more of a digest for broader audiences. But I think that recent scholarship has really shown how much Seneca's views are actually really anchored in core Stoic doctrine. So there's no watering down there. But in order also, and this is a second really important point, in order to get at Seneca's philosophical views, you can also not just focus on arguments and technical terms, because, of course, original Stoicism is very strong precisely in that area. But you really have to take his entire mode of expression into account. And I would like to tip my head a bit at some of my colleagues. Margaret Graefer and Julia Wildberger have done really great work to keep all those aspects of Seneca together. And then in a way, we should also take Seneca's tragedies into account, which is what I did not do in my contribution. But you know, there's a very good volume by Katharina Volk and Garrett Williams on Seeing Seneca Whole, for example. All right, so as with these prerequisites out of the way, there were three topics that I focused on in my contribution. So what kind of model of the soul do we find in Seneca? And then his treatment of the pre-emotions, and then what I would call, and also if this builds on earlier work of mine, his discourse of self. So what is at stake with the first topic? In all the scholarship, you find a technical term that is often applied to authors of this period, namely that they're eclectic. In other words, that they just borrow little bits and pieces from different schools of thought. And for example, people have argued that for Seneca's model of the soul, and he was very heavily indebted to Platonist and Aristotelian perspectives, whereas I belong more in the group, in the school of thought that states that no, these elements are there, but they really have been harmonized under a Stoic perspective, and a Stoic perspective is dominant, and there is a coherent view. It's not just something that has been cobbled together. Syncretism is another technical term that people use for that kind of writing. So Seneca really adheres to the key Stoic notion of a unified soul, meaning that it does not have lower parts or functions. And that means that both virtue and vice are described in terms of rationality. So with virtue, we have a correct functioning of reasoning and a correct value judgments. With vice, vice results from the wrong kinds of value judgments. Now, a specific case in which we see Seneca apply this is in his theory of the pre-emotions. The Stoics really wanted us to stay clear of the passions. The passions are a complete disruption of the correct functioning of the soul. But Seneca acknowledged that there were sort of initial reactions that we might have. So something happens, we have an initial reaction to it, and we start maybe with initial value judgments, which actually sometimes are even unconscious. Then we might not even be fully aware that we have these value judgments. So he's talking about pre-emotions in his treatise on anger, right? And he's saying, so we have basically two judgments that are required. First, that something bad has happened. And second, that a certain response, namely anger, is appropriate. Now, we might start out with these almost on an unconscious level, or sometimes conscious level. But the passion anger, according to Seneca, can still be avoided as long as we don't ascend to those value judgments. Right, so we can still push the pause button if you want, and we can, for instance, still say to ourselves, "No, no, this is not really bad. You know, this is the only thing that is evil is vice. So this actually, what just happened might be morally indifferent, and certainly it's not appropriate for me to lash out in a movement of anger." So what you there have in Seneca's analysis of the pre-emotions is actually, it's our most sophisticated account of how these pre-emotions are supposed to work. And there might be a Seneca and a specific touch of Seneca in them that he really wants to draw a very clear line between those initial reactions, which are not just like blushing or withdrawing my hand when I touch fire, but also they also happen on the level of value judgments, and a full-blown passion, which in fact can still be avoided if we manage to correct our initial response. And then in the third part of my paper, which I call the Discourse of Self, there I really try to show, I try to give an example that it's not just all, because the pre-emotions bit is very technical, very sophisticated argument. Not surprisingly, lots of scholars have focused on it. But you can also see the philosophy at work, for instance, in the text on tranquility through the discourse of self. And what I mean by that is simply all the different ways that Seneca describes of how we relate to ourselves. It's also very much expressed in reflexive language, like we can be on constant guard of ourselves, we can flee ourselves, we can examine ourselves, and you can actually map the moral progress that he's arguing for in this text on tranquility through the different modes of relating to oneself. And once you start paying attention to it, it's really fabulous how he manages to use that as an instrument to convey these key insights of Stoic ethics. And they're still related to psychology, because the true self, of course, is reason, which the Stoics call the governing principle of the soul. And then I just end with some reflections, because this is very, very unusual for us. When we think of self, we tend to think of an individual. But Seneca, like other Stoics, as I have argued in other contexts, sees the self as fundamentally embedded. It's not like this boundary of an individual versus everything else that exists around us. So for a Stoic like Seneca, the self is fundamentally embedded in a web of social relations, and it is fundamentally embedded in this overall order, the cosmos, which they see as being governed by divine rationality. So from the human soul, from the psychology, from the self, you can also arrive actually then at social ethics, or at this idea of an overarching order or an overarching rationality in the universe, which the Stoics very much endorsed.
Thank you very much for...
We could use a lot of more of today.
For sure, yeah. David, Gretchen, and Meta, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us on New Books Network. The book we discuss is The Oxford Handbook of Roman Philosophy, published in 2023 by Oxford University Press. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Morteza.
My pleasure. When do academics not like to talk about their work, right?
And that's what New Books Network is for.